So good afternoon, everyone. I'm very happy to have this opportunity to address all of you. And although I will be making a few general remarks and observations about Buddhism and the Buddhist tradition and how it relates to the area of education, which is a subject that I'm very interested in and devoted to myself. Understanding that in your own lives, your efforts to promote GNH in the national curriculum is one which is taking a more secular approach, then I would try to express myself in those more general secular terms whenever I can. But to begin with, I would like to repeat a point I've been making in a number of places since I arrived. And it is an observation of the religious traditions in the world. The religions that grew up in the Middle East, particularly the great monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, we often refer to them as the great faiths. And that in itself points to the essence or the essential feature, the prime virtue promoted by those religions is faith. And we can refer to those religions as belief systems. And as Western culture is the dominant culture in the world today, the understanding of religion is very much influenced by the Western viewpoint, which is, as I say, developed in the midst of these faith-based religions or belief systems, to the extent to which the word religion is used as a general term, and we are led to understand that all religions are basically the same thing. They're all doing the same job. They might use some different terms, but they're all essentially trying to teach the same values and lead to the same goals. Now, I would say very bluntly here that I don't agree with that. I don't think it's an accurate, it's an ideal. It would be very nice, I would think, if there was that kind of harmony, but I don't think it's the case. The people who most enthusiastically talk about the unity of religions are usually the ones that know the least about them. I would say in particular that Buddhism is a very different kind of religion. I would almost call it a different species of religion. And that we run a great danger of misunderstanding our own Buddhist heritage and of not deriving the benefit that we should derive from our Buddhist heritage when we see it as a belief system, as a faith. I would say that the use of the word the Buddhist faith is already an inaccurate and incorrect appellation. So my proposal is that Buddhism is essentially an education system. If you look at the Buddhist texts and compare it with the Bible, the Quran, the texts of other religions, there is a huge difference in the content, style, and almost in every aspect of those books. Now, speaking of Buddhism in particular, we can say that it's founded upon the human being. It's not concerned with creating a particular or correct relationship between the human being and the divine. It is based upon a belief in the capacity of the human being for enlightenment and the capacity of the human being for education and for transformation. If we compare human beings with most animals, we see a significant difference. Most animals are self-sufficient within a very short time, some within hours, some within days, some within months. They learn everything they need to learn from their parents and their environment to enable them to survive the rest of their life. Human beings take years and years before they are self-sufficient. And they don't just learn what they need to survive at a very early period and then just make use of that knowledge. But we have the ability, the capacity for lifetime learning. And what Buddhism says is that our humanity lies in that capacity, in our ability, our capacity for lifetime learning. It's what makes us truly human. And the kind of learning which is considered most essential to our happiness and welfare is the understanding of how to abandon all of the negative qualities within us, how to develop and to bring to maturation all the positive qualities, and how to purify our minds. The summation of this Buddhist scheme of education of every aspect of our lives, of body, speech and mind, is what we call enlightenment. And the enlightened being was called by the Buddha the Asekha Pugala. And we can translate that into English very simply as the graduate. Someone who has graduated from life. So the enlightened person is the only true graduate. And everyone else is learning. So Buddhism teaches us to perceive ourselves, to look at ourselves as learners. We're learning. And how that applies in, particularly in an educational context, is that we don't look at a school or a college as being composed of teachers and learners or students, but as different kinds of students. So you have one group of students is called the pupil, are called the pupils. The second group of students are called the teachers. And the third group of students are called the parents. And this education process will really thrive when we're able to instill that idea that just as the pupil is encouraged never to be complacent, but constantly seeking to develop more and more, then similarly the teacher should never be complacent about his knowledge and teaching skills. And particularly when we also introduce the idea of teachers as role models, then becomes even more essential that the teacher is constantly perceiving himself or herself as student of life. And thirdly, we need to be able to bring the parents in also, that they are students. They are students of life, but they are also students themselves, students of how to be good sons and daughters themselves, if they still have living parents, how to be good parents, how to be good spouses, how to be good human beings. So this is why, you know, I think that of the great religious traditions, Buddhism offers unparalleled resources for an education system, and one which is grounded upon Buddhist psychological principles will be very effective, because the Buddha was the person who plumbed the profound depths of human nature. There's no religious tradition, no philosophical tradition, which has even a tiny percentage of the insights into the nature of human consciousness that the Buddhist tradition possesses. On one occasion, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, in a meeting with Western academics, referred, not slightingly and not patronizingly, but listening to a presentation on Western psychology, he said, "This is baby psychology. You know, it's like this is so basic compared with what is taught in the Buddhist traditions. This is a wonderful resource that we have." Now, speaking in particular on the development of GNH and GNH values in the school system in Bhutan, for instance, one thing I think to be wary of is that most traditions teach virtues that we should possess, and indeed many traditions will tell us you should be like this, you should be like that, you should not be like this, you should not be like that. A good person is kind and unselfish and sharing, and a bad person is greedy, and so on and so forth. So we all heard this so many times, haven't we? What we should be like and what we should not be like. And maybe that's the way that we teach our children and our students. You should be like this and you should be like that. But the simple point, the problem that remains is that we're so very rarely given any tools, any practical everyday means to promote positive qualities and to remove the obstacles to their development. And if that's the case, then we're always in the realm of ideals. You know, and we can comfort ourselves and say, well, yes, we teach kindness, we teach compassion, we teach unselfishness, we teach honesty, and really believe that we are teaching them, when in fact all we're doing is telling people, you should be kind, you should be compassionate, you should be this and you should be that. So psychologically it's naive and ineffective, and what can often happen is that people who are constantly taught in that way start to feel, I'm hopeless, I'm bad, I should be this and I'm not, you know, and feel very discouraged. So what I feel that the Buddhist tradition has to offer, and it can also be offered in a very non-Buddhist idiom, if we wish for that, if we feel that's necessary, are specific technologies, specific methods and techniques of embodying, of bringing into real life the kinds of ideals that we uphold. So I'm going to give you, a few pointers and observations and principles. Firstly, that although in English we often use the word meditation, the Buddha himself, surprisingly perhaps, never used that word. The word that the Buddha used most commonly is bhavana, which means cultivation or development. And the Buddha didn't confine it to spiritual development as such, but pointed out that any human development, positive development or cultivation, must be a holistic, organic development, one which encompasses every aspect of our lives. If we don't grasp this particular point, all that meditation will provide us, and in fact it's not a small thing at all, and that it is stress reduction. But meditation as a transformative tool in our lives will only really come about when it is integrated with a whole attitude to life, a whole system of development. The Buddha made very clear that morality is the indispensable foundation for spiritual growth. And here, also perhaps carrying on from the point I made about the uniqueness of the Buddhist tradition, is that whereas if we look in a rather superficial way at the precepts that lay Buddhists uphold and compare it with the commandments in the Christian tradition or the rules of other traditions, we can see more or less the same thing. But there are some very crucial differences here. One is that there is no reward and punishment system in Buddhism. There's no deity going to give you a reward if you live a moral life, and there's no one going to punish you if you lead an immoral life. There's the leading of a moral life in the Buddhist tradition is one which must come about voluntarily. If there's any sense of external compulsion, or if one is acting, conducting oneself in a particular way, purely for a desire for material advancement, or prestige, or position, or praise, then it will be quite a good thing sometimes, but it will not be the kind of morality which is a training, which is a form of education. So the Buddhist approach is that precepts are forms of education. So if we take the basic precepts, we can say, I undertake to educate my conduct by refraining from killing and harming living beings. I undertake to educate my conduct through refraining from taking anything which is not freely given to me. I make an undertaking to educate, to train my conduct through refraining from adultery and sexual misconduct, and so on. Now, the idea behind this is one, again, confidence in our capacity to act wisely and to train ourselves. We start off by asking ourselves, what kind of family, what kind of community, what kind of society would we like to live in? What kind of society would we like our children to grow up in? What would be the bottom line that we would say we can feel relieved and confident in the safety of our children, the well-being of our children? I think one of the kinds of answers, and I've asked many groups of people in many different places this kind of question, is we need to feel that we're physically safe, that we're not going to be physically oppressed, hurt, abused. We need to have some sense of security for our property. We need to have some sense of security and freedom from worry that someone will try to take our partner, our loved one, away from us, or that our partner is having affairs behind our back. We need to feel that sense of trust and relaxation that that when people speak to us, that they're telling the truth and they're not lying and cheating us. We'd like to live in communities where we feel people are responsible for their actions, not under the influence of alcohol and drugs. So if we have certain basic principles for a healthy society, a society in which we can trust each other, in which we feel secure, in which we feel some affection and care for each other, the next step from that is, what are the practical steps that we can take to promote the kind of families and communities that we would like to live in? And here, the Buddha suggests that we draw upon a universal human quality or gift, and that is the ability to refrain. Now, you can see with animals that that's not possible. If you have a cat that likes to chase rats and eat them, you know, even if that cat has a lot of affection for you and listens to you, and even if you could speak cat language, I don't think you could get that cat to stop chasing rats because its instincts are so powerful. Now, human beings, we also have those kinds of instincts for survival, for sex, for procreation, all these kinds of instincts, and they're not evil. But we do have the ability to stand back from our animal instincts and make judgments. Well, I won't do this. Would you want to do it? Oh, yes. Well, why not do it? Oh, it would be so hurtful to that person. Or it wouldn't be right. I just wouldn't feel right to do that. So this is a basic human quality we have. It's a wonderful quality where in certain circumstances we can say, I won't follow my instincts. I won't do this. I won't say that because it would create problems and consequences, suffering for myself and others. It's not worth it, basically. So, in the moral realm, if we voluntarily take upon ourselves certain boundaries and certain restrictions, and we can maintain our conduct within those restrictions, we have the basis for self-respect. We have the basis for healthy, supportive communities externally, and internally we have the self-respect and self-esteem necessary for further spiritual practice. And this question of self-esteem, the other main pillar supporting that sense of self-respect and self-esteem is generosity. When we act generously, when we give, when we share with others, we see immediately that we, just little old me, we may not have a very high opinion of ourselves, but we can see through certain actions, a certain speech, we can reduce, even by a little bit, someone else's suffering. We can increase, even by a little bit, someone else's happiness. And we say, I'm not just nothing in this world. I'm not a meaningless bit of driftwood. I make a positive impact on the world I live in, even if it's in very modest ways. So generosity and a voluntary acceptance of boundaries for conduct, these are the foundations for an effective meditation practice. If you're not acting in that way, You won't be a friend to yourself. You won't have self-respect. And the kind of perseverance and effort needed to be successful in meditation practice will not be accessible to you. As you start to put effort into meditation practice, you begin to think, I don't deserve this. I don't deserve peace. I don't deserve this. Why? Because I'm such a bad person. I'm always doing things that make other people unhappy, and I'm always this. No, I'm such a bad person. I can't do this. I don't deserve to be able to do it. So these are the kind of the psychological impediments to spiritual practice, which are very strong in people who are not careful about the quality of their actions and speech. Now, given that we are putting effort in our daily life to be kind and generous and to be mindful and aware of our actions and speech, next thing is a daily meditation practice. Now, for meditation to be a transformative element of our lives, it cannot just be 1 or 2 minutes a day. For the real work of meditation to take place, you need a much greater investment of time and energy. Just to digress a little bit, a book that I would recommend people read, not a Buddhist book, but a book of general interest, a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers, which is a book dealing with the conditions underlying success. And he relates in one chapter of this book that he... that in a study at one of the leading music schools in America, so the school, these children or these students already quite proficient in their musical talents, were divided into 3 groups: the really gifted, the moderately gifted, and the lesser gifted. And then they did some research on how many hours a day these children practiced. Now, the assumption would be that the gifted children, the ones that just from birth have found everything very easy, would need to practice and would practice much less than the lesser gifted children, who have to make up for their lack of inherent ability through hard work. What they found was that it was exactly the opposite. The more gifted the student, the more hours a day they practiced. And the a theory was developed from these studies that for true proficiency, for true excellence in any skill, you need to make an investment of about 10,000 hours. So that's if you're meditating 1 or 2 minutes a day, try and work out how many years or lifetimes before you get your 10,000 hours. So now I'd like to just to give you a few pointers about meditation practice, because there doesn't seem to be much clarity about this. Now, initially, meditation is an effort to increase attention span. These days, attention spans are becoming shorter and shorter. And it's a major problem in education systems everywhere. And the more as Bhutan develops, physically and materially, you will find that the attention span of children declines unless there are really diligent efforts to prevent that happening. The Buddha referred to the mind already 2,500 years ago, before modern distractions, as the monkey mind. So it's the natural tendency of the mind to wander all over the place. Now, because we don't see our minds in the same way that we can see and smell our bodies, very few people have a concept of mental hygiene in the way that they have a physical hygiene. So if you don't bathe very often, you become aware, you feel uncomfortable, and your body will start to smell. That's the nature of the physical body, which means that most people are quite diligent about bathing. But nobody can see your mind. And you, unless you make a conscious effort to look at your mind, you won't see it either. And so we're very alienated from our minds. We're very unaware of the springs of our actions. We lie to ourselves, we're deluded, we consider ourselves far more rational than we actually are. And there are many, many studies these days to show this in a very practical and knowledgeable way. I'll give you this is just kind of an entertaining, I think, example of how much less rational than we may think. This is not a matter of whether or not you study science. This is just normal and natural. A group of people were given two options. One option was a completely free weekend holiday in Paris, staying in a 5-star hotel, everything laid on, completely free. The second option was a completely free, all expenses paid, 5-star hotel, etc., etc., holiday in Rome. So you had to choose one or the other. So there was in the initial study, it was about 50-50. Half the people thought they'd like to go to Paris and see the Eiffel Tower, and half wanted to go to Rome and see all the things that Rome has to offer. Now, the next stage of this study, a third option was introduced. And the third option was you could have a weekend in Rome, all expenses paid, 5-star hotel, etc., etc., but you have to pay for the coffee. So now you had three choices rather than two. The initial group were asked to deal with these three options. Now, if we were completely rational beings, option number three would have no impact at all, because there's no value added to option two. Instead of getting everything for free in Rome, now you have to pay for coffee. So if we were rational beings, the second time this test was done, you'd get exactly the same result. 50% want to go to Paris, 50% go to Rome. But what happens is, in the second case, something like 80% of the people now want option two, Rome free. And only about 20% or 20-something percent still go for Paris. Suddenly, option two has become more attractive than option one, even though nothing has changed at all. And the reason being that option two, a completely free Rome, now seems more attractive because it has Rome with a penalty involved. It's not a not quite so attractive Rome. And so I just offer this as just one of hundreds of examples of ways in which we're unaware of how irrational our minds are. I have many, many examples of this to tell people who are rather proud of their rational powers, but time doesn't permit that right now. So what I'm proposing is that, generally speaking, we have very little understanding of what's going on in our minds. It's like someone who drives a car and never opened the car. You know, they've always just depended on the garage. And then when, as long as the car's driving along, they're fine. But then when the car breaks down, they don't know what to do because they never learned about an engine and they don't know how a car works. And most of us are in that kind of state. So meditation is not just a way of just kind of blissing out and just forgetting all our troubles. What it's doing is providing us a tool in which we can understand ourselves more clearly and to develop skillful means of identifying and dealing with negative mental qualities and find ways of promoting and developing positive mental qualities. So it's providing us a technology, it's providing us a means of putting this GNA, these GNH values, into action within ourselves, and only when we're able to do that, of course, are we able to model them. Now, the basic principle of the first stage of meditation is that the mind, in order to let go of its distractions and its usual preoccupations, needs an anchor. So you can't go from attaching and running after all these different moods and emotions to a point of objectless peace. The intermediate stage is you have to hold on to one thing and then let go of everything else except that one thing. So this is an important principle. So we are developing intention span, developing mindfulness of an object. Now, the object that I would recommend that you might like to try yourself is the breathing process. This is a valuable tool in many ways because everybody breathes. You know, it's not a Buddhist function of the human body. We're all breathing all the time. And it's a matter of merely focusing on something which we usually take for granted, except for when we're walking up a steep hill or when we have difficulties in breathing. So the sensation of the breath at a particular point in the body. Usually we'll use an area around the tip of the nose, but it's not a fixed thing. And it's wherever you can recognize, acknowledge, you feel the breath most clearly. So it might be nearer your lip, at the tip of your nose, even inside your nostril. It could even be somewhere else. It could be in your throat or in your chest. It's not important, but that's your workplace. That's where you're going to sustain your attention. And then you make the effort to sustain the attention for the whole duration of an in-breath and the whole duration of an out-breath. And what you'll find is that we're very good at the beginning of something, but then our attention gradually wanders off and we lose it. So you'll find immediately that you can't do it. And this is a very humbling and sobering fact, I would hope for all of us, that you have so little inner control, inner administration of your own mind, that you cannot even sustain attention on your breathing for more than a second or more at a time without your mind wandering off. And that's, a really terrible thing. How can we be spiritually mature people? How can we be developing values consistently and well and wisely if we have that little inner integrity and control? So what do we do about it? Well, nothing too esoteric or difficult. It's just very patiently bring your attention back to the breath. So it wanders away into the past, into the future, thinking about this and that, and then you, once you realize, you stop and you return to the breath. So the breath is your anchor. Now, you start to observe all kinds of things about your mind through this simple practice. So, I would compare it to looking at your mind or being self-aware in daily life is like trying to follow a rapidly moving object against a background of many different colors. It's very difficult to do that. But if you have a single color as a screen, and if you have a grid on it, then it's very much easier to follow a moving object. So the breath, the mindfulness of the breath, fulfills the function of a single colored screen in which you are able to recognize all the ways in which you are not peaceful. And this is an extremely important part of self-knowledge and self-awareness. So you begin to see for yourself the extent to which petty kind of desires and attachments, the craving for excitement and stimulation, how much that conditions your mind, the petty irritations and aversions, the laziness, the sloth, the torpor of the mind, the agitations in the mind, the doubts, all these things are rising and passing away again and again in your mind, and whenever they arise in your mind unobserved, then they will have an effect. But being aware of these negative qualities, not as my negative qualities, but simply aspects of nature which are now being revealed to the eye of awareness, then we learn how to let them go. And so many meditators can become discouraged. You say, I can't meditate, I'm not very good at it. You say, well, why? Well, before, you know, just a few seconds and my mind's gone off somewhere and I'm bringing it back. But that's completely normal. And it's not that you're wasting your time when that occurs. You're developing a mental muscle. If your mind wanders, you realize that's a moment of awakening. It's a moment of enlightenment. And then you're willing to let go of the interest and the enjoyment of that thought, that fantasy, or whatever it might be, and return to the present moment. You're developing the quality of renunciation. So you're learning, you're sharpening your ability to observe what's going on in your mind. You're learning how to let go of negative emotions. You're developing the ability to re-establish your awareness in the present moment every time that your mind goes somewhere and you realize and you come back to your breath. And what you will notice in your daily life if you do this on a regular basis is that you become distracted less often. You become aware of distraction more quickly, and you are able to re-establish your attention in the present moment more easily. Now, in this effort to develop, attempt to lengthen the attention span, to create this state of inner, relaxed wakefulness, it is important to realize that you cannot use willpower and just drive negative thoughts out of your mind. That kind of aggressive approach won't work. The time of the Buddha, there was a young man of good family who ordained as a monk, and he was very devoted to practice, had so much faith. His name was Sona. And he had this idea of all you need is kind of devotion and faith and commitment and just sort of blast your way through all the obstacles. And he's doing walking meditation walking up and down for hour after hour after hour. Because he was very wealthy and he wasn't used to walking that way, he wasn't used to walking bare feet, he cut his feet to ribbons. And he kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And the Buddha realized what was going on, and the Buddha visited him. And the Buddha said to him, Sona, before you became a monk, did you like to play the lute, like a guitar, a musical instrument? And he said, yes, Lord, I did. And he said, when you played the lute, what would happen if the strings were too loose? And he said, well, you get a very bad sound. He said, what happened if you tightened the string too tight? And he said, the strings would snap. So how do you get a good sound from your musical instrument? Well, you have to tighten the strings just the right amount. Not too tight, not too loose. And the Buddha said, that's exactly how you meditate. Not too tight, not too loose. Another image to convey this idea for how you meditate is if you imagine a small bird in your hand. Now, if you were to hold that bird too tightly, you would hurt the bird or you might even kill it. But if you were to open your hand too much, the bird might fly away. So how would you hold that small bird? Just enough that it doesn't fly away, but not so tightly that you hurt the bird. That's how you hold your mind in meditation. But you can't just get like one state. Yeah, this is the just right state, and sustain that. Because in the course of meditation, your mind will be changing, and you have to be adjusting that tension. Maybe making it a little bit tighter, or a little bit looser. And this is the art of meditation, being able to develop skillful means to adjust the quality of your attention as situations change. As the mind becomes calmer, the breath will change, you become very, very subtle, almost disappear. For some people, the breath can disappear altogether. So there are many different experiences in meditation. Now, time doesn't permit me to I've already gone over the time I meant to do. Just a few more points about meditation. It's important to recognize that these kinds of hindrances we have in our mind are not us, they're not who we are, we don't have to feel bad or inferior, they're just normal conditioned phenomena that have arisen through habits created over many, many lifetimes, but that they can be removed through this practice of meditation. And if you persevere with meditation, the image here is of a dripping tap. To begin with, your awareness is like the water dropping from a tap. It's like drop, drip, drip, drip. And so the sound between the drips is when you're distracted. Now, as you practice more, the time that you're distracted becomes diminished, becomes less, and the mindful, bright, clear moments are increased. So it's now like your tap is drip, 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 drip. And then, finally, you have continuity of mindfulness. You are totally awake, aware, relaxed. There is this balance of sharpness and relaxation and clarity and flexibility and stability of mind. And this is like a stream of water. And this is what we call samadhi or samatha or concentration. And it's this which provides the mental factors necessary for the higher levels of meditation where we're developing wisdom and insight. Now, if you have even a small experience of inner peace, it will transform your life. I would compare it to someone who's lived in a very unpleasant place, let's say in a slum, from the moment they're born, they never ever went anywhere else. All they know around them is this horrible, dirty, smelly, unpleasant, unkind place. But because they've never known anything different, they don't really think about it. And then one day, someone takes them by the hand and says, let's go for a walk, and they climb out of the slum, out of the town, out of the city, up into the mountains, and suddenly they're on top of a mountain, and it's this is fresh air. Oh, this is sky. Oh, this is nature. Oh, I just never imagined. And then the wisdom comes up, where I live my life is such a nasty, dirty, unpleasant place. You see, the insight into that unsatisfactoriness of the usual place can only come about when you have a new perspective on it, something to compare it with. And so when you have that comparison, then you begin to see, oh yes, anger, irritation, and jealousy, and confusion, and things, these are really such horrible things. I really don't want them in my life anymore. Unless you have seen non-greed, and non-hatred, and non-delusion, in at least in that form of a short period of inner peace, you can never really develop the tools to abandon them. So developing that inner peace gives you a great deal of self-confidence also. Oh, this is something I can do. It's not impossible. It's not just for lamas in the monastery. It's something anybody can do if you're willing to make the necessary effort. And I'm proposing here that this kind of inner work is absolutely indispensable for someone who wants to fully appreciate the wonder of being born as a human being and to experience and to, you know, we understand in Buddhism, before you can take birth as a human being, you have to create so much good karma over so many lifetimes. So that's just to be born one of these 7,000 million people on this planet. But to be born in a Buddhist country, in a Buddhist culture, or in a culture which supports mind training, or in a country which has a goal of gross national happiness, how much good karma have you created in the past? But that's just like the money you have, that's your foundation. The next thing is, what are you going to do with that? You know, where do you go from here? It's a foundation, but it's not a given. So I'm trying to explain that this sense of inner transformation will bring happiness and welfare to yourself, happiness and welfare to your families and communities and the country that you live in, and in your particular job and role and responsibility as teachers. The extent to which you can embody and model this transformation will very much affect the extent to which you can instill it in your pupils. So I would like to end my talk at this point.